Why do we need to meditate? Why do we need to take neurochemical cocktails to stimulate these things? Or are these just treatments for a failing system where, again, we're now we've been usurped by the side of a brain that clearly doesn't have these abilities? So yeah, I think there is a whole palette of things in there, including a different kind of immune function, which I've already alluded to. There's a strong case to be made that a lot of traditional approaches to human health or unhealth was simply to induce an altered state, and that would take care of it. Well, what on earth's going on there? What on earth's wrong with the immune system when it's being run by the left brain? And so on and so on. So, a lot of possibilities locked away in our right brain, very well documented. And when you start putting them all together, there isn't anything that we currently can do in our normal left brain state that we couldn't do 50, 100, 1,000 times better if we could find a way to permanently access these latent abilities.
Now, I know you got involved in some personal research I'd like you to share with us. One way of trying to tackle this is to selectively shut down the left brain, isn't it? And we know that sleep deprivation can do that. Can you explain to us what you did? Because the results are pretty interesting, to say the least. I'm talking about the Manchester experiment, right?
Yes. Going back about 20 years, I got interested in all of this, and I started to look at what people had been doing to access. You know, at the time, I was quite skeptical. I mean, I did begin to look at what people were doing to get into these states, or what happened when they reported these states, and there seemed to be a common pattern. There were these ancient traditions, some of which I've touched on, classic ones being things like meditation or the kind of Trappist approach, not speaking, more vision quest. Some of these traditions are still alive. Again, it can rely on cocktails of certain groups of chemicals which seem to asymmetrically stimulate the right hemisphere more than the left. And then there was this tradition of staying awake for long periods, either it was sometimes under the guise of prolonged meditation. I think the tradition of the Buddha's enlightenment was tied in with meditating for 6 or 7 days under the Bodhi tree. Well, again, people talk about meditation, but unless you've fallen asleep, that's prolonged sleep deprivation. Then right. There's the sort of North American traditions, again, where people would stay awake for 3, 4, 5 days waiting for the vision to come, much more visual view of things, much more coherent view.
That turns up in shamanic training, doesn't it? Can I just say something there, Tony? That turns up in shamanic training, the deprivation.
Yes.
I mean, food and, you know, food deprivation as well as sleep.
Yes.
In one of my books, I told an amazing story of a guy who was walled up in an ice house for 30 days. This was an Eskimo from the far north.
All right.
And I knew it.
Yeah.
And he had his vision, exactly as you say, his vision, his right brain vision eventually came. But what was absolutely stunning about this story is that what he dreamed of was a blonde white woman. He'd never seen such a thing and didn't know such a thing even existed.
Well,
I mean, most of us, when we go to sleep, probably tend to dream of blonde white women. But why Eskimos? You know, we've seen them in real life. That's what I mean. So,
Yeah.
That's a very important part of spiritual training, isn't it, to sleep deprivation?
Well, of course, there's nothing new in these approaches. Now, I'm not claiming to have, you know, discovered anything new, rather just trying to translate it in a language our left brain or my left brain can understand. And, you know, back to the sleep, just to explain that a little bit more. I mean, yes, again, nothing new in these approaches. And what I did back about 20 years ago, I changed my diet because I knew enough about, at that time, I knew enough about plant biochemistry, and I thought, well, this has got to make a massive difference. It's basic engineering. If you build and run something on a radically different bunch of compounds, it's going to work differently, simple as that. So I'd already changed my diet, and then I got interested in what else I could do just to sort of see how it might affect my own personal experiences. And staying awake seemed, you know, there's no prohibition on staying awake as yet. And I thought it would be an interesting combination with a much more natural diet. So I started staying awake myself, probably it was about 1995. And I was quite lucky. I had some very interesting experiences early on that convinced me this was a worthwhile area of experimentation. So I did about 3 years of quite a lot of sleep deprivation runs, anything from about 3 days to about 7 days. And perhaps, you know, maybe over 100 experiments in my own time. And they were absolutely fascinating and still are to this day. I still do that kind of stuff from time to time now. And what seems to happen is it really does. It starves the batteries. It starves the ability of the rational mind, my normal sense of self, weakens it, and you go through a window of feeling tired, of course, and irritable, and your speech can begin to slur. Well, of course, we know the left brain seems to be speech dominant. Coordination can become more difficult and so on. So there is a window of dysfunction, if you like. But I think what also happens is the ability of the left side of the brain to maintain its dominance also begins to falter. And usually within 2 to 3 days, it's possible to start getting glimpses of these states that people have alluded to forever. And they're pretty damned amazing. They feel amazing, and there's a fluidity comes. The sleep, the tiredness begins to diminish, believe it or not. Usually 3 to 4 days into these experiments, I found myself being absolutely perplexed. Well, actually, I don't feel tired anymore, and I'm starting to feel really good. And things like my handedness, I'm normally very strongly right-handed, that would change. I was becoming more ambidextrous. I felt like I had more strength and stamina. Of course, I was aware that, you know, self-assessment's very dangerous and sleep deprivation can lead to delusion. So I managed to persuade a university in Manchester to sort of objectively run some tests. And they had me up there. They let me stay awake for 5 days. They were a bit worried I'd perhaps go crazy or maybe even die. So it was limited to 5 days. And I said, well, look, I'd be happy if I stay steady state. If at the end of 5 days my functions are as good as they are on day one, that should be interesting, because all the orthodox literature suggests, you know, a great loss of function, particularly with things like balance and coordination and so on. So we ran the experiment for 5 days. I was filmed. There was always somebody with me, and they were running a battery of tests every 3 hours, different kinds of tests. And it went better than I'd hoped, really, and I've got some of the data online. Basically, all my functions improved, including things like dexterity test, coordination. And interestingly, my left hand, which I've always pondered about handedness in humans, you know, I've often wondered why I have this kind of clumsy left hand that never does quite what I wanted to, and it's not as delicate and dexterous and so on. Well, it seemed to catch up and overtake my right hand to some degree, and it turned out to be faster than my right hand. It's a lot of these tests. So again, some physical changes that were moving in the direction that was highly unexpected. In fact, the people running this study, initially they said they'd publish it, probably to demonstrate the level of delusion I was suffering. But once the results were coming through, clear something strange was going on, and suddenly the publishing idea went out the window, and there was talk of, well, we'll have to do this again, but we haven't got any money, and so on and so forth. So unfortunately, I've never had the resources to repeat it, but the data, the sum raw data that still exists, and it points to something strange going on when you combine a diet that is in accordance with our evolutionary origins, and then you stay awake. Well, something strange happens, and that's exactly what some of the, you know, the yogis and so on were talking about. Eat a natural diet, employ some of these techniques, and something magical starts to happen. Of course, it sounds like a bunch of nonsense to the rational mind today, but actually the mechanisms are there that might just make sense of this.
Can you describe these states in any way for us? I mean, I know it's difficult, isn't it? But was there this kind of spiritual loss of identity and the oceanic feeling, you know, like the Maslow's peak experiences and so on? All have very similar descriptions, don't they?
Sure. Yes.
Get that, well, kind of thing? Share it with us if you can.
Yeah, I'll do my best. I mean, it is difficult to describe, and I always feel a bit clumsy with, you know, my vocabulary is not the best in the world, so trying to find ways to describe something that is wholly other is quite tricky. I'd go as far as saying, yes, I mean, some of these states certainly seem to resonate with what other people have reported, and yes, you know, trying to find the words, certainly profound in essence, feeling at times like, you know, I think in some of the more intense experiences, it's almost like part of me was observing this. Perhaps the part of me that's normally totally in charge was in the back room just watching or something. And at times I wondered if it was possible to die from an endorphin overdose. I'd feel so intensely, you know, it was like a peak orgasmic state and some, and it just wouldn't stop. You know, some of this, sometimes this went on for hours. Of course, absolutely compelling and fascinating. I mean, I remember one occasion where I'd been awake, I think, for 2 or 3 days, and this switchover, is the best way I can describe it, kicked in perhaps earlier than I expected. And I remember lying, I was just kind of initially incapacitated because of the intensity of the pleasure. I was just lying there totally, my whole, you know, every cell in my body was screaming in sort of some kind of extreme ecstasy. Very pleasant experience, obviously.
Right. You know, what about a residual, Tony? Is there much left when you come down from these states? I mean, does it inform the rest of your life? Like some people, you know, they've taken LSD and it blew their mind so much, their understanding of reality shifted, and they never went back to how they were. Do you get a residual from what you're talking about?
Yes, I think two things. It totally, those experiences totally turned everything upside down. I mean, the reason we're having this conversation is I spent the next 20 years trying to figure it all out and repeating some of the experiments and so on. So it totally changed my whole rational approach to my priorities in my life, in the classic sense. Yes, nothing was ever the same. But it did leave and does leave. I think, I mean, a lot of it is about repetition. I think that even in the milder forms of approaches, there's not many people turn up, meditate once and have a profound experience. It's usually about repetition and discipline, and it can take quite a while for these states to begin to emerge. I don't think it's any different with the more powerful approaches. You might be able to dip your toes in a bit deeper, a bit more quickly, but it's the repetition where you begin, instead of just being blown away and going, oh my God, that was an amazing experience, you begin to sort of navigate the experience when you're in it. And actually, there's a whole landscape there that's, at least for me anyway, was totally new. I wasn't familiar with it, but with time and practice, you begin to be able to sort of navigate your way around it. And I think with that practice, then in more normal states, you can still tap in a little bit. I wouldn't say I certainly haven't found a way to stay in those states permanently, but it certainly got easier to get into those states. And there would be a residual experience, you know, there'd be like a reverberation, a feel-good factor, perhaps more, my mind worked differently. I mean, it's, you know, time will tell whether what I've come up with has any validity, but the theory itself, primarily, you know, the curiosity was there, but the theory and the detail has largely come out of those altered states. You know, the insights and piecing the jigsaw together didn't come from my rational mind. I'm just not sharp enough to do that. But in those states, I'd see things very differently. Like seeing everything all at once, but it was coherent. I could make sense of it. It wasn't overwhelming. And with practice, I could pull that back through into my rational mind and try and translate it into a way that made sense. So I'd say the last 20 years has been totally about those experiences and still is today. Yeah, nothing's ever been the same again.
Right. Listen, one of the things I've enjoyed in this series, Tony, is linking, you know, what some experts are saying with other experts. And I know in your book, you address the subject of music and how that can alter consciousness. We had a wonderful speaker about 6 weeks ago, my friend Gary Malkin. He's an Emmy Award-winning composer, composes film music, but also music to alter consciousness.
Yeah.
That's a very right brain thing, isn't it, music? How does that work?
I'd say a lot of these things fit into similar categories. You know, trying to get into these states, you're either looking at inhibiting the left side of the brain by whatever technique, stimulating the right side, or combinations of both. And it's helped by some kind of engineering rebuild, which again kind of makes sense if we're in poor shape. And I think music, particularly complex music, flowing music, is beyond the neural, the cognitive, whatever, the perceptual capacity of the left brain. Now, remember, I'm saying it's actually reverted to a more primitive type, which is a harsh thing to say, but then I have one, so I can get away with saying that. It's not very musical. It doesn't, you know, it's not very complex in any of its abilities. So these more complex musical forms, totally, it just washes over. It doesn't react at all. In order to hear that kind of music, you have to borrow more function from the right brain, or it will stimulate the right brain. And I think that's why music has been such a part of these traditions. You often have a hypnotic beat, something to keep the left brain happy, because it's easily, you know, it's easily sort of engaged with a very simple beat. It can follow beat fine, but if you really want to engage the right brain, you want something much more complex. And I think there's echoes even in the kind of early rave movement, quite complex music, often with some kind of neurochemical stimulation, and dance, often very flowing movement, not rigid movement. Well, the left brain can't do that. You know, I couldn't sink to save my life in my normal state, and I'd feel incredibly terrified to do so. But my voice certainly does change in these altered states, and the music sounds, instead of music sounding, oh, well, yeah, that's quite nice, it becomes all-encompassing. You almost feel like you become the music, and it's profound and ecstatic. And I think music, almost that's like a tuning fork. You know, if you find the right kind of form of music, it will stimulate that function in the right brain and bring it more to the fore, and it pulls through all these other traits, so you start feeling very, very different. Well, you're moving more to a right brain dominant state, and music is a very powerful technique to do that.
Right, it is true, isn't it? I know that if you damage the, significantly physically damage left brain, so that a person loses their speech ability, that person can still sing, and even sing with words, which I think is quite amazing, actually.
Yes, again, well, a classic idea, the left brain has decided speech is one of its crowning glories. I'm not saying everybody buys into that, but that's certainly often what you see in the popular sort of press. And yet, typically, certainly past puberty, at least, the left brain is pretty awful at singing. Yet the right brain, it seems, can sing. What are the origins of speech? Is left brain speech just a dumbed down form of singing? And you're quite right. You know, I've yet to come across any cases where people have had significant damage to their right hemisphere where suddenly people have turned out to be phenomenal musicians or they can sing. It's always the other way around. There's a pattern there. The really good stuff only comes if you damage the left brain in such a way it loses some control, and then you tap into this. And as you say, there's an ability to sing, and there's some cases where people have, learned to talk again. And in fact, one of my early experiences, just briefly, if we've got time, one of my very early sleep deprivation experiences, I think I was lucky, but it was quite bizarre, where I ended up in a state where I felt paralyzed down my right hand side. My right arm had pins and needles, my right leg, all down that right side. My left side felt very fluidic, I could move it, but I couldn't speak. I had no speech initially, and of course I could have been quite frightened, but in that state I was very calm, and I thought, it felt interesting, and I wasn't thinking in words. I'm narrating this now in words because I have no choice. And after about maybe 5 to 10 minutes, and with some effort, I found my voice again. It took a while, and my voice sounded very different. I had a friend in the room who knew me quite well, and I was speaking, but from a very different place. My voice sounded different. It was very poetic, but very communicative. So I think there is a parallel communication system, but normally we don't get access to it. We're stuck with this kind of fairly monotone thing that exchanges concepts and thinks they're real, and that's currently where the left brain's at. It's not really cutting edge at all.
There's just one thing I think we should add, though, just really to make the point that it's not all that simple, is it? It is very complex. There are many examples of left brain damage leading to things like really florid schizophrenia, not exactly paradise and godlike abilities on the right side. It can go horribly wrong just shutting down the left, so presumably it's doing something there.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, talking about shutting down the left and so on, I'm looking at this from a perspective that we're in deep, deep trouble here. So I'm looking for clues as to make sense of this, and is there a way back? I'm not suggesting we should ever have operated with a shut down left hemisphere, though I suspect that might be less problematic than a damaged left hemisphere, because if it's still perceptually dominant, all you're going to have is a left hemisphere that's even more dysfunctional than average, hence the problems. So it's just the case where sometimes damage can lead to glimpses. I think that's all it is. It's just glimpses. But of course, damage can lead to dysfunction, which is what you'd expect. So yes, it's not just as simple as some damage is going to lead to anything wonderful. Occasionally it does, and it's always left damage opens up the door to something else.
Tony, you've been great. I want people to be able to connect with you, to download your book and so on. Give us some links, where places on the web that people can go, and I can repeat the
Well, obviously we can only touch on this subject. It's such, it's 20 years of stuff, really, so I hope it's whetted people's appetite. But there is a lot of information online. There's two sites, really. There's Left in the Dark. It's www.leftinthedark.org.uk. There's sort of quite a lot of information on there, and papers and stuff to download. And then the sister site, which has a little bit more pictorial information, it's perhaps a bit easier to follow for some people. That's Beyond Belief. That's www.beyond-belief.org.uk. And again, a different perspective telling the same story. And yes, I mean, there is a book. I'd say it's an outline. There's still a lot of data that could be filled in, but it provides a good outline, I think, and that's Left in the Dark, and you can get that at Amazon, or you can get it on the Left in the Dark site.
Right. Tony, you've been great, absolutely fascinating, and a totally different spin on the things that we've been talking about, you know. And I think it's great. I'm trying to bring a whole picture about the science of being and consciousness, and your contribution is massive, really. It goes in a completely different direction. And I very much appreciate the time that you've spent coming and talking to us. I hope a lot of people will connect with you and help you advance your theories. I think that you connected with something else. Now, listen, my left brain has gone a bit foggy today. I probably need some more caffeine. But a site for people who want to work on, you have to fill me in here, want to get together researching consciousness and so on. Do you know what I'm talking about? If so, fill me in.
Say that again, a site that, what, sorry?
A collection of people who are wanting to get together and research consciousness. I think some time ago I was on that, or connected with your site anyway.
Oh, right. It could be, I did have a site up for a while. I think it was obviously the rather predictable site. It might have been Choose Right Now. It was a site that had some problems. It's going to relaunch again, I'm hoping sometime in the next month. But the idea was to draw people together who are interested in the possibility that our neural system isn't as functional as we'd like to think, and, you know, looking at how to move things forward. But that site's currently down. I'm hoping it's going to be up, as I say, roughly in a month or so. So I'll mention it now, if that's the site you're talking about.
I don't think it was. International Center of Consciousness. It's just come to me.
Oh, right. Okay.
It's neural.net, isn't it? Which is a clever.
Oh, I see. I'm with you now. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was so... I should have written it down, then I could have brought it to your attention.
No,
but anyway,
I was a bit lost, but yeah. Sorry?
Are you connected with that personally?
No, I'm not. I mean, I've written an email pretty much everybody over the last 20 years, but it's perhaps only in the last 5 years or so where I've managed to get my own theory coherent enough for me to understand, let alone anybody else, that I'm starting to get a lot more interest. So... yeah, I mean, I'm constantly in touch with people, but obviously what I'm proposing is somewhat challenging, because on the one hand, I'm driven by the idea of solutions, but I can't see how we can start getting to solutions if we don't have an accurate diagnosis. And while there are many, many people looking at, you know, ideas of evolving and things that can help, I'm taking quite a harsh view and saying, no, we've crashed severely here. There's a serious problem, which is in accordance with the ancient traditions. And until we take that on board, you know, if there's a serious problem in our perceptual equipment, we'll be chasing our tails forever. We won't even know what questions to ask, let alone find appropriate solutions. And not everybody initially wants to hear that, but I think with what's going on in the world today, it's becoming an easier sell to suggest that there's something seriously amiss here. It's not just about expecting us to behave wonderfully better, because we've been expecting that of ourselves for thousands of years, and yet here we are, and we've had access to techniques for thousands of years, from meditation to use of neurochemical analogs and so on, and still here we are. So I'm not sure these approaches that are being touted around today really can cut it anymore. You know, I think the condition is much more severe, and that initially is quite shocking, but it also opens up the door to, you know, if the causal problem is a neurological problem, challenging though that is, it brings it back to a human scale fix. And we already know an awful lot about the micro structure of the brain, the molecular regime of the brain. If you change it just a little bit, you get a massive impact on perception and state of mind. Things, you know, again, I'm not suggesting for a second that this is about a deficiency in things like MDMA, for example, but we know that people who are very aggressive, very violent, once they had access to some of these chemicals, massive transformation. And to me, there's almost a taboo around this area. We'll do anything but look at the structure, which seems to Of course, I'm not saying we are a structure, but it seems to facilitate the music we play as ourselves. Why we won't look at the structure, we almost legislate against any change in structure while we expect massive change in behavior. Well, we've got it all back to front. Tiny changes in structure, as long as they're judicious and we know what we're doing, guaranteed will make a massive difference in our behavior and perception. And the evolutionary data is saying we've lost this, you know, this incredibly complex cocktail of chemicals. There's no argument there. Nobody's saying, no, we didn't come, at least not in the orthodox picture anyway. We came from the forest. We were flooded with a massive cocktail of chemicals. Now we're not. These are very basic proposals. And it's a case of saying, well, is it worth looking at the possibility that maybe we needed those chemicals to function properly? Because, well, as you know, the neural system is a drug machine. It cannot operate without a very complex cocktail of drugs, and we've lost the richest cocktail that, you know, that the biological evolution has ever produced. That's what we ran on. Now we don't, and look at our behavior. Maybe there's a connection there. Is it worth at least looking at?
And thank you to Dr. Keith Scott Mumsby for that interview from June 2012. We've looked at the divided brain once before on the show, episode 537. A friend of mine described this as a show of two halves and intimated that he really couldn't fathom the second half on divided societies, the cultural roots of separation. I'm going to give that a re-listen in light of Tony Wright's thoughts. Now let's hear the introduction and a little bit from the first half of that show. This is, after the introduction, Professor Ian McGilchrist's thoughts on the relationship between the two hemispheres of the brain.
On the show, we are continuing loosely from last week's look at the need to shake off hierarchical structures and the need to recognize pathological thinking for what it is, only we're returning to the traditional unwelcome guests format. It's two lectures by academics, both of which will reward re-listening. In our second hour, I think this is one of the deepest talks we've ever had on Unwelcome Guests, the roots and ramifications of our culture of hierarchy and control, by a retired history professor, Marvin Bram. He's speaking 7 years ago. Now, he makes too many points for me to summarise that briefly, so I'll speak more on it just before we listen to it. But he's similar in his conclusion that there is something very amiss with modern society, and he's not talking about decades or even centuries. He's tracing it much further back, and I find this a very welcome antidote to short-term reflexive thinking, of which there seems to be so much nowadays. Our first speaker, Ian McGilchrist, is looking, I think, at the same phenomenon of separation, but not within individuals in a society. He's looking at within the structure of an individual human brain. And he looks at the roles of the two different hemispheres, the left being the cold, calculating, abstracting, logical, computer-like half, which doesn't tolerate ambiguity, which doesn't perceive context, relationships, which can't do fuzzy thinking, and the right, which is more about relationships, which tolerates ambiguity, which has a predilection for the living over the dead. And although he's focusing on the individual brain, he looks at the impacts for society and concludes that what we call enlightenment was marking the ascendancy of the left brain over the right brain. The logical thinking, the reduction of the infinitely complex to simple mental models, so that law and simplified ideas of justice could be applied to it. And he suggests that just before the collapse of Greece and Rome, similar tendencies were evidenced, which should give us some food for thought.
The division of the brain is something neuroscientists don't like to talk about anymore. It enjoyed a sort of popularity in the 60s and 70s after the first split brain operations, and it led to a sort of popularization which has since been proved to be entirely false. It's not true that one part of the brain does reason and the other does emotion. Both are profoundly involved in both. It's not true that language resides only in the left hemisphere. It doesn't. Important aspects are in the right. It's not true that visual imagery is only in the right hemisphere. Lots of it is in the left. And so in a sort of fit of despair, people have given up talking about it. But the problem won't really go away, because this organ, which is all about making connection, is profoundly divided. I didn't make the division. It's there inside all of us. And it's got more divided over the course of human evolution. So that the ratio of the corpus callosum, the band of tissue that you can see there, the right hemisphere has been pulled aside in this drawing to show you this band of fibers that connects the hemispheres at their base. The ratio of the size of that to the volume of the hemispheres has got smaller over evolution. And the plot thickens when you realize that one of the main, if not the main, function of the corpus callosum is in fact to inhibit. It's to inhibit the other hemisphere. So something very important is going on here about keeping things apart from one another. And not only that, the brain is profoundly asymmetric. Now, I'm not going to go into all the information in this slide. Just to help you orientate yourselves, you're looking at the bottom of the brain there. You're looking upwards, which is why the right is on the left and the left is on the right, just to make it a little bit easier. And what it shows is that there are asymmetries in the brain. Principally, it's broader at the back on the left and broader on the right at the front, and slightly juts forward and backward at those parts as well. And it's as though somebody got hold of the brain from underneath and given it a sort of sharp twist clockwise. Now, what is all that about? If one just needed more brain space, one would do it symmetrically. The skull is symmetrical. The box in which all this is contained is symmetrical. Why go to trouble to expand some bits of one hemisphere and some bits of another, unless they were doing rather different things? What are they doing? Well, it's not just we who have these divided brains. Birds and animals have them as well. And so I thought it might be a good idea to have a look at what we know about lateralization of the hemispheres in birds and animals. And it turns out that this has to do with attention. And I think the simplest way to think of it is if you imagine a bird trying to feed on a seed against a background of grit or pebbles, it's got to focus very narrowly and clearly on that little seed and be able to pick it out against that background. But it's also, if it's going to stay alive, it's got to actually keep a quite different kind of attention open. It's got to be on the lookout for predators or for friends, for conspecifics, but for whatever else is going on. Now, it seems that birds and animals quite reliably use their left hemisphere for this narrow focused attention to something it already knows is of importance to it. And they keep their right hemisphere vigilant broadly for whatever might be without any commitment as to what that might be. And they also use their right hemispheres for making connections with the world. So they approach their mates and bond with their mates more using the right hemisphere. And one can see this because of the way the eyes are related to the hemispheres. So that is interesting as a starting point. But then you come to the humans. And it's true that actually in humans too, this kind of attention is one of the big differences. The right hemisphere gives sustained, broad, open vigilance, alertness, where the left hemisphere gives narrow, sharply focused attention to detail. And people who lose their right hemispheres have a pathological narrowing of the window of attention. But humans are different. The big thing about humans is their frontal lobes. And for those of you who are not neuroscientists, you might think the frontal lobe was just this bit of your brain sort of somewhere up here behind your forehead. But it isn't. It's about 35% of your brain. It's an enormously large chunk of your brain. And the purpose of that part of the brain? To inhibit the rest of the brain, to stop the immediate happening. So standing back in time and space from the immediacy of experience. And that enables us to do two things. It enables us to do what neuroscientists are always telling us we're very good at, which is outwitting the other party. Being Machiavellian is the word. And that's interesting to me, because that's absolutely right. We can read other people's minds and intentions, and if we so want to, we can deceive them. But the bit that's always curiously missed out here is that it also enables us to empathize for the first time, because there's a sort of necessary distance from the world. If you're right up against it, you just bite. But if you can stand back and see that other individual is an individual like me, who might have interests and values and feelings like mine, then you can make a bond. There's a sort of necessary distance, as there is in reading. Too close, you can't see anything. Too far, you can't read it. So the distance from the world that is provided is profoundly creative of all that is human, both the Machiavellian and the Erasmian. Now, to do the Machiavellian stuff, to manipulate the world, which is very important, we need to be able to interact with the world and use it for our benefit. Food is the starting point, but we also, with our left hemispheres, grasp using our right hand things and make tools. We also use that part of language to grasp things, as we say. It pins them down. So when we already know something's important and we want to be precise about it, we use our left hemispheres in that way. And to do that, we need a simplified version of reality. It's no good if you're fighting a campaign, having all the information on all the plant species that grow in the terrain of battle. What you need is to know the specifics of where certain things are that matter to you particularly. And so you have a map and you have little flags. It's not reality, but it works better for some purposes. One of the things about the right hemisphere is that because it has this broad open attention, and because actually it's more integrated with our bodies, it seems to have the vividness of experience fresh before it. It has what Heidegger calls presencing. Whereas the left hemisphere takes that information and uses it, disposes it in a clever way, simplifies it, and it represents it. And one way of talking about this is of something a bit like a map of the world, which has its uses. And language can be part of that map. It's tokens for things, words for realities. And in the left hemisphere of the brain, one sees this representation going on. Now, this, I wanted to show you very, very briefly some pictures. This is with one hemisphere inactivated at a time. So on the left, you've got a tree drawn by both hemispheres. In the middle, you've got the left hemisphere's version. Notice the left hemisphere is only interested in the right side of space. You can see this on any acute medical ward with somebody who's had a right hemisphere stroke. They may neglect anything on the left because it's not of use to the left hemisphere. It's only the bit that it's interested in using. And you can see how exuberant the tree by the right hemisphere is. This is flowers, a similar picture, reduced to symbols, tokens, by the left hemisphere. These are all drawn by the left hemisphere, and as you see, on the left you have a cube, but it has no depth. You have a table, similarly. You have a tree, reduced to a few lines. You have a person, reduced to a formula. And you have a flower there, which is a purely symbolic flower. So that is the nature of that kind of reality. Here I just show that the right hemisphere has much more depth, less symbolic representation, more the actual in-depth experience. And here is an illustration from a book of Gazzaniga's showing after an operation, that's the lower level, after the commissurotomy, that's when the corpus callosum is divided, so that the two parts of the brain can't speak to one another. Before the operation, obviously draws a very good cube with the right hand. But that information has come from the left hemisphere, because when it's cut off, look what it does. It's a flat representation. So there's something that's happened there to the three-dimensional nature of reality. Now, I haven't got time to go into all these differences, and I haven't got time to talk, unfortunately, about the asymmetries of the brain. There is a long, long chapter in my book in which I talk about all the evidence that I've gathered about the way it affects our, the asymmetries between the hemispheres give us different takes on the world. The newness of the right hemisphere makes it a devil's advocate. It's always on the lookout for things that might be different from our expectations. It sees things in context. It understands implicit meaning, metaphor, body language, emotional expression in the face. It deals with an embodied world in which we stand embodied in relation to a world that is concrete. It understands individuals, not just categories. It actually has a disposition for the living rather than the mechanical. And this is so marked that even in a left-hander who is actually using their right hemisphere in daily life to manipulate tools with their left hand, it is their left hemisphere, not their right hemisphere, in which tools and machines are coded. So this is very interesting. And it changes the view of the body. The body becomes an assemblage of parts in the left hemisphere. There's a different emotional timbre. I wish I had time to talk about it, as about how it affects our understanding of music, time, and the self. If I had to sum it all up, I would get away from all those things that we used to say, reason and imagination. Let me make it very clear. For imagination, you need both hemispheres. Let me make it very clear. For reason, you need both hemispheres. To do a kind of very schematic, rationalistic processing like a computer would, you can use your left hemisphere. But to reason fully, you need both hemispheres. And a lot of mathematical thinking and deduction is done in the right hemisphere. So if I had to sum it up, I'd say the world of the left hemisphere, dependent on denotative language and abstraction, yields clarity and power to manipulate things that are known, fixed, static, isolated, decontextualized, explicit, disembodied, general in nature, but ultimately lifeless. The right hemisphere, by contrast, yields a world of individual, changing, evolving, interconnected, implicit, incarnate, living beings within the context of the lived world, but in the nature of things never fully graspable, never perfectly known, as we think. And to this world, it exists in a certain relationship, rather than just an objective stance. The knowledge that's mediated by the left hemisphere is, however, within a closed system. It has the advantage of perfection, but the perfection is bought ultimately at the price of emptiness, of self-reference. It can mediate knowledge only in terms of a mechanical rearrangement of other things it already knows. Now, I would have liked to have time to read some extracts, perhaps I do, from this book, just to show you that actually what I'm talking about is not as abstract as it sounds. If we think about mechanism first, you know when somebody's right hemisphere is not working, they start to, that their world on the left is just produced by the left hemisphere. It's no longer produced by the right hemisphere. It's had a stroke. There's a description here of a patient by Ehrenwald, where the left half of his chest, abdomen and stomach should be, he's got only a wooden plank. It goes right down to his anus and is divided into compartments by transverse planks. Food doesn't follow the usual path from the stomach through the intestines. It, quote, gets sucked into the compartments of this scaffolding and it falls through the hole at the bottom of the framework. All this is only on the left side. So this is very interesting. And if you think about this virtuality, tokens for things, I really would like to read you this short extract about a whole series of patients, this was research done by a very prominent neuroscientist called Marcel Ginzburn and a Russian colleague called Deglin, when they looked at how people reasoned. They gave them false syllogisms, and that means one of the premises is wrong, and what deduction do you draw? So, major premise, all monkeys climb trees. Minor premise, the porcupine is a monkey, which clearly it isn't. Implied conclusion, the porcupine climbs trees. Well, does it? They just demonstrated each hemisphere has its own way of approaching this question. At the outset of the experiment, when the intact individual is asked, does the porcupine climb trees? She replies, using, of course, both hemispheres, it doesn't climb, the porcupine runs on the ground, it's prickly, it's not a monkey. During experimental temporary hemisphere inactivations, the left hemisphere of the very same individual, with the right hemisphere knocked out, replies that the conclusion is true. The porcupine climbs trees, since it's a monkey. When the experimenter asks, but is the porcupine a monkey? She replies she knows it's not. When the syllogism is presented again, however, she's a little nonplussed, but replies in the affirmative, since that's what's written on the card. When the right hemisphere of the same individual is asked if the syllogism is true, she replies, how can it climb trees? It's not a monkey. It's wrong here. So there's that. And there's another very important thing about Lethem. He's a huge optimist, and it indulges in a degree of denial. So great is this denial. This is a neurological fact. It's not just an opinion I have about the left hemisphere. If somebody had a stroke involving the left-hand side of the body, their right hemisphere not operating, because it doesn't fit with the left hemisphere's idea of itself that there could be anything wrong with it, it will deny that there's a problem. It's not paralyzed at all. We'll move it then, and no movement will happen. But the patient will insist that they've just moved their arm. I just wanted to read you this little extract. So, an examiner talking to a patient. Whose arm is this? That's pointing to the paralyzed arm. It's not mine. Whose is it? It's my mother's. How on earth does it happen to be here? I don't know. I found it in my bed. And so on. And then when the hemispheres are, when there's a procedure whereby you can temporarily activate the right hemisphere, she goes back to completely accepting that she's got a paralyzed arm. But once that wears off, she goes back to, it's my mother's, nothing to do with me, Gov. So there's something there which is really extraordinary happening, which you can actually see happening, which is about denial. Now, I'm going to be very quick now and just talk about the broader implications of what I've just said to you. There's a problem here about the nature of the two worlds. They offer us two versions of the world, and obviously we combine them in different ways all the time. We need to rely on certain things to manipulate the world, but for a broad understanding of it, we need to use knowledge that comes from the right hemisphere. And it's my suggestion to you that in the history of Western culture, and I deal with this in the second half of the book, in Greek culture, in Roman culture, and indeed in our own culture since the Renaissance, things started in the 6th century BC in the Augustan era and in the 15th, 16th century in Europe with a wonderful balancing of these hemispheres. But in each case, it drifted further to the left hemisphere's point of view. The Enlightenment specialized in separating the head from the body. In fact, the French Revolution developed a special technique for doing this. What I'd like to bring to your attention is Berlin's famous characterization of this Western way of thinking. He said there were three things which applied, in our view, to all knowledge. All questions can be answered. Anyone who's lived knows that can't be right. All answers can be transmitted to others. They can't. They're not information that we can be fed in, like into a computer. You need to draw it out of someone else who has to already have it in them. And all answers are compatible. If only. So when you come a little bit later to Blake, I put this up because it shows the picture of the spirit of Milton entering his body through his, as he says, through the left tarsus, going direct inspiration to his right hemisphere, in fact, in an area near the limbic system, which is the part that serves emotional understanding. Blake knew that opposites, innocence and experience, share something of one another. Nowadays, we live in a world which is paradoxical. It's very frustrating. We pursue happiness, and it leads to resentment, and it leads to unhappiness, and it leads, in fact, to an explosion of mental illness. That is the world we now live in. We've pursued freedom, but we now live in a world which is more monitored by CCTV cameras, and in which our daily lives are more subjected to what de Tocqueville called a network of small, complicated rules that cover the surface of life and strangle freedom. More information. We have it in spades, but we get less and less able to use it, to understand it, to be wise. There's a paradoxical relationship, as I know as a psychiatrist, between adversity and fulfillment, between restraint and freedom, between the knowledge of the parts and wisdom about the whole. It's the machine model again that is supposed to answer everything, but it doesn't. Think about this. Even rationality is grounded in a leap of intuition. There is no way you can rationally prove that rationality is a good way to look at the world. We intuit that it is very helpful. And logic, ethics, and aesthetics are all of this quality. We say that they're made up out of bits that we've now worked out. It's a utility thing, beauty and morality. But as Wittgenstein wisely pointed out, all these areas are transcendental. We have to make a leap of intuition to understand them. And this is not new. At the other end of the process, rationality, we know from Gödel's theorem, we know from what Pascal was saying hundreds of years before Gödel, that the end point of rationality is to demonstrate the limits to rationality. There are paradoxes in logic, these are the great things in the Greek world that came into prominence about the time that we started to use the left hemisphere more at the end of that period. So reality is not linear, it's curvilinear, and there is a conjunction of opposites that we used to understand. In our modern world, we've developed something that looks awfully like the left hemisphere's world. We prioritize the virtual over the real. The technical becomes important. Bureaucracy flourishes. The picture, however, is fragmented. There's a loss of uniqueness. The how has become subsumed in what. And the need for control leads to a paranoia in society that we need to govern and control everything. Everything that should be implicit becomes explicit, and the life is drained. Why this shift? I think there are three reasons, very quickly. One is the left hemisphere's talk is very convincing because it shaved everything that it doesn't find fits with its model off and cut it out. So this particular model is entirely self-consistent, largely because it's made itself so, and it's therefore very compelling. I also call the left hemisphere the Berlusconi of the brain because it controls the media. It's the one with which we... It's very vocal on its own behalf. The right hemisphere doesn't have a voice, and it can't construct these same arguments. And I also think, rather more importantly, there's a sort of hall of mirrors effect. The more we get trapped into this, the more we undercut and ironize things that might have led us out of it, and we just get reflected back into more of what we know about what we know about what we know. So I mentioned obliquely Donald Rumsfeld earlier, dreadful man, but a brilliant philosopher. It's not the things that you know you don't know that bring you down in life. It's those unknown unknowns. And I just want to make it clear, I'm not against whatever it is the left hemisphere has to offer. Nobody could be more passionate in an age in which we neglect reason and we neglect careful use of language. Nobody could be more passionate than myself about language and about reason. It's just that I'm even more passionate about the right hemisphere and the need to return what that knows to a broader context. So it's that business about the emissary going back to the master, not usurping the master. And when I'd finished this book, I came across a quote from Einstein that I wish I'd known when I was writing it. Because it turned out that Einstein's thinking somehow presaged this thing about the structure of the brain. He said, "The intuitive mind is a sacred gift, and the rational mind is a faithful servant. We have created a society that honors the servant, but has forgotten the gift." Thank you.
Now, that talk of the giver, a perfect excuse for me to replay a thought from episode 537 about how money and the gift economy relates to this left-right brain dichotomy.
Money could still perhaps exist as a gift economy, but isn't it somehow an expression of the left brain's desire to want to quantify, understand, and control everything, to reduce the spontaneity, the variety, the whirl of confusion that is real life to a one-dimensional shadow, to mathematics that can be maximized, quantified? So even leaving aside issues such as the fact that the system's controlled by psychopaths, I think in a real sense, a world in which money plays an important part is a left-center dominated world.
Now, if Tony Wright's thoughts about co-evolution of human and plants brought Michael Pollan to mind, then we're thinking along similar lines. I thought I'd end the show with the end of his talk as featured on episode 525 about cannabis.
The seeker, the spiritual seeker, you think about it, works to put aside past and future, the better to toe the line of the present moment. And there are many examples in both Eastern and Western thought where this experience of the present becomes our doorway onto eternity. In the West, Boethius said the spiritual goal is to hold and possess the whole fullness of life in one moment, here and now, past and present and to come. And there's the Zen master who said, "Awakening to this present instant, we realize the infinite is the finite of each instant." What I'm suggesting is we can't get from here to there without first forgetting. And we will find that it is the cannabinoids that mediate this process. But isn't there something a little artificial about this? How does this make us feel? Is a chemically conditioned spiritual experience any less real? Does it make a difference if the chemical involved is endogenous or artificial? And why? Huxley wrote about this a little bit. He said that all our experiences are chemically conditioned, of course. And if we imagine that some of them are purely spiritual, purely intellectual, or purely aesthetic, it is merely because we have never troubled to investigate the internal chemical environment at the moment of their occurrence. So humans have found many ways to fiddle with their brain chemistry. And that's exactly what's going on. Meditation, fasting, risk. Even the placebo effect, remember, we're not just fooling ourselves into thinking we're happier when we take a placebo antidepressant. We're actually producing more serotonin. So why does using a plant like cannabis still strike us, for spiritual purposes, strike us as false and cheap? Is it the work ethic? No pain, no gain? I think the problem is really the provenance of those chemicals in this case, that they come from outside us. And even worse, that they come from nature, from plants. We have a name for someone who believes spiritual knowledge might come from such a quarter, and that is a pagan. And we have a story about that, and it's called Genesis. For what was the knowledge God wanted to keep from Adam and Eve in the garden? I would argue that the content was not nearly as important as the form, that there was spiritual knowledge to be had from nature, from a plant. The tree in the garden was a seriously psychoactive plant. And the new monotheistic faith had sought to break the human bond with magic nature, to disenchant the world of plants and animals by directing our gaze to a single God in the sky. But this new God can't just pretend the tree of knowledge didn't exist, not when generations of plant worshiping and consuming pagans knew better. So the tree of knowledge is allowed to grow in the Garden of Eden, but ringed around now with a powerful taboo. Taste it and you will be punished. And interestingly, the punishment involves remembering, involves falling into history and shame. And this, I suggest, is the drug war's first battle. But I want to end on a much more positive and, well, intoxicating note. This is from a passage from the book. Plants with the power to revise our thoughts and perceptions, to provoke metaphor and wonder, challenge our ingrained Judeo-Christian belief that our conscious waking selves somehow stand apart from nature, have achieved a kind of transcendence, or that kind of transcendence. Just what happens to this flattering self-portrait if we discover that transcendence itself owes to molecules that flow through our brains and at the same time through the plants in the garden? If some of the brightest fruit of human culture are in fact rooted deeply in the earth with the plants and fungi, is nature then, as Sartre claimed, mute? Or might it mean that spirit is in fact part of nature? Well, there may be no older idea in the world. In The Birth of Tragedy, Friedrich Nietzsche described Dionysian intoxication as nature overpowering mind, nature having her way with us. The Greeks understood that this was not something to be undertaken lightly or too often. Intoxication for them was a carefully circumscribed ritual, never a way to live, because they understood that Dionysus can make angels of us or animals. It all depends. Even so, letting nature have her way with us now and again still seems like a useful thing to do, if only as a check on our hubris, if only to bring our abstracted upward gaze back down to earth for a time. What a re-enchantment of the world that would be, to look around us and see that the plants and the trees of knowledge grow in the garden still. Thank you very much.
This show and all previous episodes are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope this show has inspired you to ask yourself, do you follow your left brain, rule-bound brain, too much? Are you sometimes giving a break, seeing the bigger picture? Listen to your holistic, contextual, life-loving, right brain. Could be good preparation for a world beyond money.